Chapter 9. Lieutenant Colonel Chang had been even more happy to hear from us, especially from Desai. She landed the big dropship as close as possible to the entrance of the underground building where Chang and his team had spent over a day hiding, waiting for rescue or for their oxygen to run out. As soon as the dropship was secured in our landing bay, I ordered a long jump to get us far away from that star system. As a courtesy, I waited for Chang to get out of his no-doubt stinking spacesuit, take a shower, drink a half-gallon of water, and grab a simple lunch before he gave me a briefing. "We're all fine now, Colonel," he reported while eating the last spoonful of soup. "Those soldiers are all admirably disciplined. When we got your signal, I ordered them to lay down, rest, and conserve oxygen, and that's what they did. No complaining, no talking. Mostly we tried to sleep a lot. We kept one person awake at all times to listen for your signal. Other than watching our oxygen gauges move toward zero and wondering what was going on upstairs, it was boring more than anything else." "Your people were down in an access shaft?" I asked. "Yes, we found an area of the site that appeared to not have been looted. There was no sign anyone had ever been there for a long time. Thick dust on the floor. No footprints. The entrance to the area was hidden. We found it by luck. It led to an access shaft. I sent four people down it. They got to the bottom, and there was a corridor." He finished the last of his soup and pushed the bowl aside. "It was a dead end. Appears to be maintenance access for the life support system. We didn't find anything useful down there." "That was worth a shot. Good call," I assured him. "You had no way to know we were about to have uninvited guests." Chang nodded slowly. "In the future, we need to bring some sort of portable shelter that has oxygen, so we don't rely only on the suits." "Agreed. We don't have anything like that aboard. We'll need to see if we can rig something up. We also, in the future, need to keep the landing party in one place with the dropship nearby. If we're going to split up a landing party, we need multiple dropships," I concluded. That was a mild criticism for myself, a lesson learned. There were a whole lot of lessons to be learned out here, for all of us, including Skippy. After talking to Chang and seeing that the 11 others were doing well and eager to continue the mission, I went to my cubbyhole of an office to get started on writing up an after-action report while it was fresh in my mind. "That was a waste of time," Skippy said bitterly, just as I sat down in my uncomfortable chair. "All that way only to find an elder site that had already been looted." "It was not a waste of time. We already discussed this," I reminded him. "We proved your method of predicting unknown elder sites is correct." "Yeah, except this one wasn't unknown. It was located at a freaking highway rest stop. There should have been a big glowing sign like Big Mike's Truck Stop. Low prices, great food. Don't miss our elder site attraction. Get a free t-shirt." "Yeah, about that, Skippy. Why wasn't that moon on your list of confirmed elder sites, since everybody else in the whole galaxy knows about it?" Maybe it was on my map in retrospect. That may have been a teensy-weensy screw-up on my part. Nothing worth mentioning." "Nothing worth mentioning, you say? Skippy, you sent us into a star system that is a superhighway of interstellar traffic. The only way that place could have more traffic is if that elder site was giving away free beer, or whatever the Kristang drink. And you told us the place was deserted. It has an unimpressive star and no habitable planet. We also had a landing party suffocate because of your teensy-weensy screw-up. Please, indulge me. Mention it." "Oh yeah, sure, blame me," he said defensively. "I had to process exabytes of pirated data to create my map, so excuse me if the final result needed some fine-tuning. Now that I have that system as a data point, I know that Elderside was indeed on the map. It was mentioned in a side note. My assumption was that an elder site would be featured prominently in any data about a star system, and that is true about all the other sites I was looking at. This particular site is a side note precisely because it is so well known. Now that I know how such places are tagged in databases, I have identified 6 other similar sites, none of which are on our target list. More importantly, I have confirmed that the other unknown potential elder sites on our list truly are not known to other spacefaring species. Unless an elder site is known and isn't in any database you have access to, because the species that knows about it wants to keep it secret." "That is always a possibility, Joe," he said glumly. Nothing I can do about that. You're right that it was not a waste of time. It was very disappointing. Now I have to wait again while we travel through empty space. I tried to cheer him up. Hey, you have been waiting a long time. What's another couple days? The next target is 10 days from here. That's more than a couple days, Joe. Yeah, less than 2 weeks. I tried to be cheery about it. 2 weeks and a barrel of monkeys, he said. Somebody please shoot me. Skippy was wrong. There was something we could do to avoid jumping into star systems that had permanently or frequently an alien presence. From now on, I determined the Flower would be jumping in first to recon the place before we jumped the Dutchman in and launched a landing party. According to Skippy, sending our captured Kristang frigate in was a waste of effort. That ship's sensors were so pitifully inadequate that it could barely find a planet. I disagreed and figured he was exaggerating. When we were near the second target, we held the Dutchman at the edge of the star system, and Colonel Chang took the Flower in. He was gone a total of 12 hours. 12 hours that were nerve-wracking hours for me. The Flower jumped back exactly on time, and Chang excitedly reported what they had found, or what they had not found. In terms of finding Skippy's magical radio, the second of Skippy's potential elder sites was another disappointment. In terms of sparking the interest of Skippy and our science team, of the entire merry band of pirates, it was a big score, a home run, a touchdown, or in soccer it would be a goal! The star, if you could call it that, was another dim red dwarf, a type of star I was getting jaded about already. There was no sign this star system had ever been visited by an intelligent species other than the Elders. The place was so boring and ordinary, there was no reason for anyone to be here, unless they thought they'd find an Elder site like we had. We found an Elder site on a small, airless moon orbiting a gas giant, right where Skippy thought it would be. From what we could tell, no one had found this site before us. No one had stripped it of valuables. The site had lain untouched for millions of years. Well, what was left of the site, anyway? What Skippy found intriguing, mostly because he didn't understand it, was that the center of the site had disappeared, been scooped out millions of years ago. Scooped out surgically. Where the center of the site used to be, where all the important Elder facilities were, was an almost perfect half-circle, gouged out of the moon. Over the eons, the edges of the circle had crumbled somewhat, and the bowl had small craters scarring its bottom from later meteor impacts. Even to my unscientific eyes, something strange had happened here. Skippy took an unusually long time processing the sensor data. We should go down there anyway. I want to get samples, he finally said, after what for him must have been a lifetime of analysis. There may be something useful in the outbuildings. I doubt it, but since we're here, we should check it out. Joe, I do not understand what happened here. Or I do understand what happened here. I don't understand why. This is Elder technology. They created a spherical field that moved everything inside that field into another space-time. This is somewhat advanced technology, very energy-intensive, even for the Elders. Why they would have done this to one of their own facilities, I have no idea. We need answers. I need answers. This time I went down to the moon in the dropship, and Chang remained aboard the Dutchman. With me were the French team, because they had missed out, if you could call it that, on landing at the first Elder site. Giraud got the honor of first boot on the ground. I was right behind him, walking gingerly in the 1/9 gravity of the small moon, taking care with every step not to launch myself 100 feet off the surface. Between the low gravity and the boosted power of the armor suit, that would have been all too easy to do. The suits had settings for low gravity, preventing an unwary, foolish, inexperienced, or merely stupid wearer from doing anything that might be fatal. Those settings could be overridden in combat. Like all the other soldiers, I was eager to test a suit in simulated combat, especially in low gravity. We poked around the site for a couple of hours, looking into mostly empty structures, and didn't find anything useful. Naturally, I couldn't resist going right up to the edge of the perfect half-sphere that had been scooped out of the moon. The lip of the sphere had crumbled somewhat over the eons, although in some places, where the sphere had cut through hard rock, the edge was still well-defined. Standing there, listening to the gentle hissing of air in my stolen alien spacesuit, looking up at the vastness of star-spangled pitch-black space above, then down at the chilling mystery of the half-sphere of moon that had been sent into another space-time, I felt small. Small, insignificant, utterly unimportant to the cold universe. I felt more than ever that humans had no place out here among the stars, so far from home. All of our problems, our hopes, our dreams, our fears of being conquered, enslaved, or wiped out by a technologically superior species, none of that meant anything to the ancient, unfeeling universe. With a shudder, I stepped back from the lip of the sphere and turned to walk back to the dropship. To my right, a group of French paratroopers were standing at the lip of the sphere, getting their pictures taken. After one or two serious poses appropriate for the significance of the site, they were showing off for the camera, doing handstands, forming a pyramid with one soldier on the shoulders of two others. Seeing that made me smile. Screw the universe. The universe didn't care about us humans. It didn't need to. We could manage fine on our own, and even have a bit of fun doing it. We were going to be all right if we had each other. Relenting to pressure from the science team, who had mostly been stuck on the ship, I let a half dozen of them go down to the surface, accompanied by Indian paratroopers. When the scientists concluded with bitter disappointment after several hours that there was nothing of value or even interest at the site, they came back to the Dutchman. I ordered course set for the next target, and we jumped away. The next day, I made the mistake of saying hello to people as I came into the gym. All I wanted to do was run on the treadmill to warm up before running down the ship's long spine. One of our SEALs took my greeting as an invitation to talk, and he hopped on the adjacent treadmill for what I quickly learned was an uncomfortable conversation. Cutting short my warm-up, I wiped my face with a towel. "I will talk to Skippy about it," I assured him. "I appreciate it, sir," he said, and sped up his treadmill as I walked out the door. I ran a series of hard sprints and thought about how to raise the subject while I cooled down on the walk back to the front of the ship. "Hey, Skippy," I called out to him once I was alone in my cabin. "Hey is for horses." "Very funny. I have a request. Some of the crew are not happy about you calling us monkeys. It's hard to explain. It's a religious thing. They don't like the idea of humans evolving from monkeys." "Oh, sure, no problemo, Joe." Wow. His simple reply surprised me. I had expected a big argument from him. "Great. Thank you, Skippy," I said with great relief. "Damn, I wish everything was that easy." "We'll cross that bridge when we come to it," he said simply. "What? I didn't use that expression correctly?"
Depends what you meant," I said carefully.
"That expression means you won't have to worry about whatever it is until it happens," I explained. "People are already unhappy, so we've crossed that bridge. You see?"
"Oh, I meant that I'll worry about it when you evolve beyond monkeys."
"What?"
"From my viewpoint, monkeys and humans are identical, so if any evolution went on, I ain't seeing it. You generally don't fling your poop at each other like monkeys do. A point in our favor.
Monkeys don't shoot each other. Advantage monkeys."
"Crap.
All right, can you do me a favor and stop calling us monkeys anyway?"
"But monkey is such a funny word, Joe."
"Granted.
Monkey, 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 monkey."
"Stop it! I can create a subroutine to say monkey until the end of time, if you like. Monkey, monkey, monkey."
"Shut up already!"
"We're done talking, then. That would be a great yeah."
"I should have known better.
We should do this less often.
You brought it up.
As you say, I am a dumb monkey. I'll remind you of that the next time you ask me for something stupid. That shouldn't take long." Rather than being alone in my office, I took my iPad to the galley for a cup of coffee. For me, not for the iPad. Desai was there, looking at something on her own tablet. She gestured me to sit with her. This was the first time we'd had some one-on-one time since I couldn't remember. Maybe ever.
"Colonel, sit down, please," she said with a welcoming smile.
"Captain, how are your trainees doing?" She took a sip of tea before answering.
"As well as can realistically be expected. Skippy is a tough instructor. He has no patience, and his social skills are non-existent."
"What? I am shocked!" I grinned.
"Right," she smiled. "It was bad before, when the trainees were only learning the absolute basics of flying the ships in peacetime. Now we're into what Skippy calls space combat maneuvers, and that is all new to me also. It's blowing my mind. I hate to say this, sir, but I may already be too old to learn flying all over again.
Space combat maneuvers? I had no idea what she was talking about.
She nodded. On Earth, pilots go to air combat school for BFM, basic fighter maneuvers. That teaches you how to turn, to climb, mostly how to manage energy in combat flying.
Manage energy? I asked, baffled. You mean fuel?
No, she laughed. For fighter aircraft, energy means airspeed and the ability to gain airspeed. For instance, some fighters are fast in a straight line, but if they make a tight turn, they bleed off a lot of kinetic energy and slow down too much, and it takes a long time for them to regain airspeed. While they're slow, they're vulnerable. Vulnerable in air combat means dead. I'm sure she was dumbing down her explanation by a factor of 10 for me. It may be more. SCM, space combat maneuvers, is completely different. There's no aerodynamics to take into account. It's about moving the ship to avoid being where the enemy thinks you are, so when they target you and fire a maser or particle beam at you, by the time the beam arrives, you're not there.
A maser beam that moves at the speed of light.
Close enough, she said.
And you're supposed to move the ship before a beam moving at the speed of light hits us? That was blowing my mind also. Isn't that like dodging a bullet?
Sort of. At the distances where most space combat happens, it takes several seconds or even minutes for a beam bolt to travel to an enemy ship. When an enemy ship shoots at us, we can't even simply fire back down the inbound beam path because while the bolt is traveling, the enemy ship has also moved.
Damn, this is complicated.
Desai nodded. So far, we've been concentrating only on the basics of flying the ship. Going into combat is an order of magnitude more complex. I'm supposed to be training the other pilots, and I still don't grasp some of the concepts. This is going to be a very difficult month.
When I got back to my office, I put aside routine reports for something much more important. Skippy, teach me about space combat maneuvers.
What? Space combat maneuvers?
Oh, sure, but hey, let's start with something easier, like monkey-level theoretical physics. How about this? The Casimir effect hypothetically allows the negative energy density to support an Einstein-Rosen bridge, also called a wormhole. Skippy, I'm serious. There is no way my tiny brain can grasp everything our pilots need to know. Man, you're making this too easy to insult. But as commander of the ship, I need to know the principles of SCM. The strategic level, not the advanced tactical understanding our pilots need. I need, and any command duty officer needs, enough situational awareness to make decisions. What do I need to know?
Wow. Yeah, great. Thanks. Is that all you want?
Start small and work your way up, all right? How about this? How can one ship ever hit another ship? Even speed of light weapons are too slow. Ships move out of the way while a particle beam is traveling. You told me about how ships use sensor fields to detect and target other ships.
What I don't get is, can't ships just jump away whenever they're in danger?
Oh boy, this is not going to be easy. I'll begin at the potty training level and we'll work our way up to Barney style if your brain hasn't exploded by then.
Fair enough.
And that's what he did. Man, I had a lot of dangerously bogus assumptions that Skippy straightened out for me. First, I had been assuming that when a ship jumped away from a battle, it was safely out of the fight. There was no way for an enemy ship to follow it. No way for the enemy to know where the ship had jumped to. Sure, if a ship micro-jumped only a few light minutes away, then shortly the enemy ship would detect the gamma ray burst from the other end of the jump because those gamma rays traveled at the speed of light. Otherwise, I thought that if a ship jumped a light hour or more away, it was effectively gone, safely away. Man, was I wrong about that. Skippy explained the way jumps work is that a ship opens a temporary wormhole at the place it wants to jump to. The far end of the wormhole opens first, and then the wormhole projects itself back to where the ship is and pulls the ship through. The reason ships come out the far end of a wormhole a fraction of a picosecond before they enter the wormhole is because of the tiny time lag between when the far end of the wormhole is created and when the near end reaches back to the ship.
Got that?
If you don't feel bad. It took me a couple of times for it to sink in. Opening a wormhole that is big enough to squeeze a ship through is something the universe and our space-time doesn't like.
even after the ship goes through and the wormhole shuts down, it doesn't completely close behind the ship right away. Ripples bounce from one end to the other, from the violence of space-time being ripped apart and being slammed closed again. Enemy ships can tell from these space-time ripples emanating from the near end of the wormhole remnant where the far end of the wormhole is. The ripples fade rapidly, so an enemy ship needs to act quickly in order to pursue a ship that jumps away. And Skippy said there are ways to fool pursuing ships by altering the resonance of the ripples. This technique is only minimally effective, because pursuing ships have ways to eliminate the noise and analyze the original ripples, measures, and countermeasures. So, jumping away provides only temporary safety for a ship. A ship has to hope its jump engine capacitors have a larger charge than pursuing ships. If a ship only has enough charge for a micro jump, it will soon have enemy ships on top of it with no way to get away. In that case, a ship has to fight in normal space while its jump engines recharge. Of course, a higher-tech species ship can almost always jump beyond the range of lower-tech ships. Even though a Kristang ship may be able to tell where a Theranan ship jumped to, it would take the Kristang ship multiple jumps to get there. By that time, the Theranan ship would have recharged, jumped far away, and the wormhole collapse ripples would have faded so much the Kristang couldn't follow. Usually. All the talk about jumping away assumes a ship is able to jump away, because enemy ships can project a damping field that envelops a ship trying to jump away and prevents a wormhole from forming correctly. If a ship caught in a damping field tries to jump, it could rupture its jump drive coils, even tear itself apart. In normal long-distance space combat, ships rely on two types of weapons, missiles and directed energy weapons like particle beams. Railguns, while they sound impressive, are too slow for most space combat, except when ships are near the gravity well of a planet and have limited space for maneuvering. Missiles carry greater destructive power. A single direct hit by a missile could take a ship out of combat. Warships are protected by defensive energy shields that can defuse direct energy beams and block missiles. The problem with missiles is that even though missiles are stealthed, they are easily detected by a ship's sensor field, and then the ship's defensive directed energy systems like masers can destroy the incoming missile. In actual combat, an attacking ship uses its energy beams to degrade an enemy ship's shields and confuse its sensors to provide a weak spot for missiles to sneak through. The whole thing made my head hurt, and it gave me a different perspective on what a ship commander needed to think about in action. I asked Skippy to set up a dumbed-down space combat maneuver training for everyone who sat in the command chair, including simulations. "How do pilots remember all this stuff?" I asked. "Not only remember, they had to understand the concepts, internalize it, until it became instinct. They're smarter than you, to put it bluntly. The pilots aboard this ship are among the elite of your species." I frowned. "And I'm a grunt who got lucky. What the hell was I doing in command of pilots and special forces soldiers who were clearly in every way better than me?" "You have your own talents, Joe, I've told you that. You went from being a sergeant to prisoner of the Ruhar to shutting down a wormhole and freeing your home planet from the Kristang. How many of our elite new crew can say that? What-ifs are fine when you're talking over a few beers, but you can't argue with success." "Thank you, Skippy. You're welcome. Now, if you'll excuse me, I need to find a fork." Not sure I had heard him correctly, I asked. "A fork? Why do you need a fork?" "Dumbing myself down enough to explain things to you contaminated my substrate beyond repair. I'm hoping if I stab my processing nodes enough times with a fork, I can kill the part where those memories are stored." Yuck. Hearing a tiny bit about space combat maneuvers from Skippy got me interested enough that I asked Desai to forward the full SCM training package to me. Reading the first section made my head hurt, and made me realize that before I could think about maneuvering the ship in combat, I needed to understand how ships operated. I approached our chief pilot again in the galley while she was sipping tea and reading something on a tablet during her off-duty time. That morning, I'd seen Desai running on a treadmill in the gym and decided not to bother her then. She'd been listening to music. By unspoken agreement, time in the gym was private time unless people wanted to be social. "Good afternoon, Captain," I said, pouring myself a half cup of coffee. In the kitchen, two French paratroopers were working on baking something for dinner. They nodded to me briefly, then went back to kneading dough. Something they had baking in the oven smelled delicious. Now, the idea of splitting cooking duties between national teams rather than bringing professional cooks aboard had been partly my idea. I'd been trying to reduce the number of people we put at risk on the mission, and UNEF had wanted to maximize our combat power. It had been an experiment. Would pilots, scientists, and spec ops soldiers resent taking time off from training to cook and clean? To my great relief, the answer was a resounding no. First, the hotshot pilots and spec ops troops were all super competitive. No team wanted to let their nation down by serving food that was anything but the absolute best. And second, the teams treated their assigned day in the galley as a mentally challenging, fun day off from the grind of training. Having a full day off meant the spec ops teams could train even harder on days when they weren't working in the galley. Doing something challenging and unfamiliar together was great for team bonding. Depending on how long our mission lasted, I considered eventually breaking up national teams and scattering people into multinational teams. Eventually, if we survived that long.
"Afternoon, Colonel," Desai gestured for me to sit down at a table.
"How is flight training going?" Training other pilots took up most of her time, and it didn't help that I insisted she be at the controls whenever we jumped into a new star system. In that star system where Skippy was sure we'd find an Elder site but came up empty, we'd had 9 days of making short jumps and maneuvering the Dutchman in normal space to establish orbit around various planets and to explore the system's extensive asteroid field. At Desai's insistence, since we felt that isolated star system was safe from us being discovered, we took the opportunity for pilots to practice flying the Flower and dropships. The Flower spent several days away from its mothership, jumping on its own, trying to hit specific targets on each short jump, dropping down into low orbit around planets, climbing out to jump distance, practicing space combat maneuvers. Dropships practiced landing on moons and asteroids, flying between the Dutchman and the Flower, and the pilots had great fun in mock combat, dropship against dropship. The Spec Ops troops, with me, Chang, and Adams, practiced free flight maneuvers outside the Dutchman. We took the opportunity for extending combat training sessions on airless moons, trying out different tactics in the unfamiliar alien armored suits. That week, while Skippy became increasingly frustrated about not finding an Elder site that should have been there, was great fun for the humans. The science team got full use of the Flying Dutchman's sophisticated sensors to explore a new star system. The pilots got to fling a Krestang frigate and Theranin dropships around in extreme maneuvers, testing the limits of themselves and the spacecraft, and ground troops, including me, got to fly around in spacesuits, race across the surface of low-gravity moons, play in war games, and learn in what did and didn't work. It had been, by far, the best 9 days of the mission. Now it was time to digest what we'd learned, share information with each other. And time for a grumpy Skippy to perform extensive maintenance on the two starships, our dropships, and our Krestang armor suits, which had suffered abuse during our week of fun.
"Flight training? We're back to basic maneuvers. We got sloppy last week. We developed bad habits."
"Fun, though," I said with a grin. "Wasn't it?"
"Oh," she laughed. "Yes, the most fun I've had since I learned to fly. Burning the Flower's engine to fling it on a low pass over a moon at 8 G's?
She shook her head gleefully.
"Nothing compares to that. The Dutchman is a much better tool for traveling between stars, but she's an ungainly pig in normal space.
I'm glad you enjoyed it. I have a question. Can you teach me to fly?"
"Teach you to fly?"
She said it slowly, as if she wasn't sure she'd heard me correctly. "The basics. I've been training with our special forces. I'm not good enough to be one of them, and I haven't trained with any team long enough to be useful. The reason I'm doing that is to understand the tactics and capabilities of each team. If I ever order them to do something, I will be informed about what they can do and how." Skippy's little tutorial on space combat maneuvers opened my eyes to how much I don't know about spaceflight and how dangerous that is. If we ever get into space combat, I want to know what our ships can do and how they do it. I took a sip of coffee. If we are ever short-handed, like when we raided that asteroid on our first mission, it would be useful for me to fill in as a co-pilot. And also, there may be situations where... I looked around the galley and lowered my voice. I don't want to ask someone else to go on a mission. Situations where taking a pilot with me is only putting another person at risk. You know what I mean, Desai. She knew. She frowned and gave me a brief, wordless nod of her head.
Do you have any flying experience at all?
None. Never taken a flight lesson, not even a ride in a single-engine plane.
Good, she announced to my surprise. You won't have any habits to unlearn. Flight training on Earth is all about aerodynamics, using airspeed to create lift. That doesn't apply out here, not even when you're flying a dropship in an atmosphere. When I got to Camp Alpha for flight training, I thought being a helicopter pilot would be an advantage in flying a vertical takeoff ship like a Buzzard. I was wrong. Even a helicopter applies the principles of aerodynamics to fly. The rotor blades act as wings. There is a saying, she smiled, that helicopters don't use aerodynamics to fly, they just beat the air into submission. With dropships and aircraft like the Buzzard, that isn't a joke. Their jets are powerful enough to hover even at high altitude, and they don't rely on wings generating lift to keep them in the air. Dropships spend most of their time in vacuum anyway. Aerodynamics aren't a factor at all. Not having to learn the principles of aerodynamics will save a tremendous amount of time. You want to learn to fly, then?
The basics, yes. Enough for emergencies. Can you do that? Teach me? She took a sip of tea and thought a minute. I appreciated that she put thought into it rather than merely indulging the whim of her commanding officer.
We can try. Basic maneuvers in space are not all that difficult. It's the navigation that is tricky, particularly orbital mechanics. We will start with the dropship first. If you get that, we'll move on to the Flower. Our stolen frigate is nimble. She flies like a large dropship. I'm sending you, she tapped her iPad, a list of training courses.
I suppressed a groan. More training materials to read. Great. I can't wait to get started. Thank you, Captain Desai.
You are welcome, Colonel Bishop.
My flight training did not take up much of Desai's time, because when Skippy discovered that I wanted to learn how to fly, he insisted on training me personally. He wasn't being nice, of course, because me learning how to pilot a dropship gave him endless material for amusement and a whole new arena to insult me and question my intelligence. Unfortunately for him, I took the training very seriously. As Desai had explained, because I was starting from absolute zero, I didn't have any habits or preconceived notions to overcome. Even reading the training material was interesting. The whole subject was new to me. I spent a lot of time in a simulator, making egregious mistakes and listening to Skippy belittle me. The crew, especially my XO, appreciated me being super busy with flight training. It meant I was out of the way and not interfering with the proper operation of the ship. For me, it meant my hours, when not taking duty shifts on the bridge and training with the Spec Ops teams, was taken up by intensive learning of a subject totally new to me. It also meant that, darn it, I did not have time to take the officer training courses that I was already behind on. Every night, or morning, or afternoon, depending on my duty shift schedule, I was so tired that I fell into dreamless slumber as soon as my head hit the pillow. Good times. Before the final jump approaching our first of the new set of targets, we tried programming another jump by ourselves without Skippy's help. Before we went into action, we wanted to know whether there was any possibility we could handle the ship on our own. This time we spent only one full day calculating which coordinates to program into the navigation computer. Our science team was somewhat more confident this time than on their first try. Skippy's PowerPoint presentation about what had gone wrong the first time we programmed a jump had indeed dazzled our brilliant science team, particularly the part where he pointed out that the speed of light was a variable and that technically the ship emerged on the other side of a jump slightly before initiating a jump. That last part blew my mind. Anyway, Major Sims was in the command chair for this jump. It was her duty shift. I stood beside the command chair and tried not to interfere. Like that was going to happen.
All systems report ready for jump, Desai reported from the left-hand pilot seat.
Until we figured out how to jump correctly, our most experienced pilot was going to be at the helm for all jumps programmed by humans.
Engage jump countdown, Sims ordered.
This is exciting, Skippy said. To bed, bath, and beyond!
Sims and I shared a glance. I think you mean to infinity and beyond, Skippy, I said. No, I figured we'd start with something small. Infinity is too ambitious for monkeys.
I didn't respond, as the jump countdown timer on the display read 3, 2, 1.
And we jumped from one empty region of interstellar space to another.
Jump successful, Desai reported. Calculating our position now.
Ah, you'll take forever. I can't stand the suspense. We emerged within 50,000 kilometers of the target,
Skippy announced cheerily. Our goal for this jump was to be within 100,000 kilometers.
Good, monkeys. Great job. Bananas for everyone.
Skippy, I admonished him. Be nice for a change.
What? Monkeys love bananas.
I did like bananas. Couldn't argue with him there.